Not long ago, on the Casey Ferguson Show Facebook page, I held the first ever Casey's Cage Match fan vote. I asked you, my dear listeners, which guest you wanted to return on episode 22 of the Casey Ferguson Show, Lee Aaron or Dan the Beast Severn. Well, the votes were in, and although it was close initially, the Metal Queen pulled ahead and came out with the victory. If you haven't heard the first part of my conversation with Lee Aaron, go back to episode 20 and check that out at www.caseyfergusonshow.com. For everyone else, this is the second part of my conversation with Juno Award winner Lee Aaron. We left off discussing the sexual marketing used early in her career and her thoughts on performers such as Miley Cyrus and Lady Gaga. Listen up.
You have children as well, and I think that your whole worldview changes once you bring a little person into the world and you see that they're like little sponges and they're influenced by everything, and you want to be giving them the healthiest possible influences. So, you know, I want my daughter to learn recording equipment and learn to play an instrument and write songs, you know. I wanted to be less concerned with her wardrobe, put it that way.
Eventually, Attic pushed the sexual button too hard and you decided to leave the label. First off, I'm proud of you for standing up for yourself, and I was hoping that you would share your story regarding the infamous ad and embarking on a journey to start your own label.
Well, I hate rehashing this because, you know, Al Mayer, the president of Attic, former president of Attic, and I are Facebook friends, and he's a lovely man, and I believe that he's still a champion of mine today. Like, he, you know, I get lots of positive feedback from him as a social media friend, right?
Right.
But you got to remember the way the industry kind of operates. It's not one single person making every decision. And sometimes what happens, or what used to happen in the record industry, is that the left hand doesn't talk to the right hand, and the marketing department runs with something that hasn't been approved by the artist and hasn't been overseen by the actual president of the label, because he's off at MeDem and he's in meetings and he's got 8,000 other things to do. Do you know
right.
what I mean?
Right.
So what happened was, when we did the Some Girls Do album, and I was not completely in agreement that Sex with Love should be the first single, because of my previous marketing, I felt that a song with the word sex in it could be, that the media might run with that, because I was Lee Aaron.
Sure.
That's what I felt. But there was a lot of pushback about that. The label thought it was a brilliant marketing idea, and that by far my career had superseded my former marketing, and that it would be a great hook to market.
Oh,
so, Sex with Love became the first single. But what then happened is, there was one of the top industry mags that used to exist back when we had actual physical magazines, was The Record, and it was pretty commonplace for labels to buy a full-page ad or a half-page ad in that mag, because it was an industry magazine, and it was well worth it. It notified everybody, there's a new album out, get ready, you know? So they bought a full-page ad, and the ad said, see sex on TV, see sex on tour, and then hear the new single by Lee Aaron, Sex with Love. I freaked out.
Let's give a hand to their marketing department for that. Brilliant idea.
Yeah. Well,
go ahead, Lee.
You know, and I see the train of thought. I see what they were going with. But I just have to tell you, when I saw that, and you know, I don't think it was Al Mayer's decision at all. I just think it was the marketing department kind of went with it, and it didn't get approved. It didn't get a round table approval, and they just thought, brilliant, let's go with that. And then, you know, when I first saw it was when it came out. You know what? My manager got like a bunch of calls from people that day going, have you seen this?
Oh, Jesus.
And, and including me, I just, you know, it felt demoralizing. So that wasn't my best day. That's all I can say. But you know what? It's all done now, and I've moved on, and, you know, I still am making music and, you know, really enjoying my life, and there you go.
Well, I mean, I'm not just trying to rehash this bullshit, but I was just kind of, you know, I was interested because obviously that decision led to you starting your own label and leaving Attic, correct?
Yeah. I mean, there were a number of other bigger sort of political business reasons why.
Like the U.S. distribution?
Well, we chose to leave Attic, and it was a sort of a collective agreement between myself, my manager, and my lawyer at the time that this might be the best option for me. And so the decision was made, and so we ended up leaving. But, you know, Attic put out a best of album, I think a year or two later, and I cooperated with them fully on it and to make it happen. It wasn't like there was any really, really, really bad blood or anything. And the reality is it was all for the best in the end, because Attic ended up, you know, merging with Polygram, which subsequently became Oasis, that got bought out by Songcore, and then, you know, and then the whole thing went down the tubes anyway. So, you know, it was the beginning of an end for everybody, and, you know, sort of the old school of the music industry anyway. So, it's a journey. I'm not the type of person that kind of sits around drowning my sorrows in the bottle of, you know, a bottle of gin or anything like that. I'm sort of like, oh, well, you know, it happened. And I think all of these experiences, good or bad, shape you. They make you into the person you are, and they inform your art. So no point in, you know, I don't think I have a bitter bone in my body, really.
I'm going to leave that one alone.
There you go.
Now, tell me a bit about your journey to start your own label. I mean, how does one even go about starting something like that?
Well, you got to remember, I've started 3 record labels. The first was Hipchick Music, the second was Spastic Plastic, and the third label, well, actually, no, then I put something out on Faithful Productions, and my third label that I just started is called Big Sister Records. That was just a few weeks ago. It's not a big deal to start a label, unless you actually want to start a label where you're going to be signing artists and investing in artists. The labels that I've had have been boutique labels specifically for my own self-releases.
Oh, okay.
So it's not a huge undertaking, except for the fact that now you're the production company. You're in charge. So what that involves is, you know, you need to raise the capital to make your record. You have to find the studio and the engineer. And if you want, if you're not self-producing, you need to find yourself a producer. And then you need to find yourself a mix studio and a mixer. So you're basically, you're like the project manager.
Did you do a Kickstarter campaign, or did you just raise the money on your own for this?
I considered a Kickstarter campaign, but by the time I was seriously considering a Kickstarter campaign, it seemed like everybody was doing a Kickstarter campaign, and I thought, you know, my gut instinct is to not milk my fans. It didn't feel right to me, so I self-financed.
Well, you milk me anytime you like. I mean, sorry.
Pardon me?
Nothing.
I went out and I just did a bunch of shows and saved up a bunch of money, and like I've done with everything in my life, and we compiled the material, we wrote the material, and it was kind of cool because it all came together pretty fast when I got determined I was going to make a new rock record. You got to remember, I've just taken a bit of a decade-long hiatus from recording. I mean, I've done other things in that decade-long time, like put out live DVDs and an anthology DVD and another 30-year commemorative CD of my work. I've done other things, but the amount of intense time that it takes to actually be the artist and write the songs and then be the producer and go into the studio and create a record, I didn't feel that I could afford that kind of time when my kids were really little, because being a mom and being a parent was really important to me. That's where most of my creative energy went, actually. So, this album, I went into, wrote the songs, and then I was very, very lucky to be able to record at a studio here in Vancouver called The Farm, which is the other half of the legendary Little Mountain studio.
Nice.
Here in Vancouver, with an engineer. I managed to secure Ben Kaplan, you just have to go look at his discography. He's done Mother Mother and Headley and a lot of really, really great, more current bands, actually. He's a really gifted guy, so he was our engineer. And then got my band, I flew Sean out, and, you know, we went and recorded our bed tracks and our guitar overdubs there, and then I took them into, again, I was very, very lucky to get connected to a gentleman named John Webster, who is a keyboard player, producer, engineer, who was for many, many years, he used to play in Red Rider with Tom Cochran, and he's played on, you name it, Bryan Adams, Jan Arden, Michael Bublé, he's the top of the tops. So that's all I can say. He's an amazingly talented Vancouver guy. And so, yeah, I went into John Webster's studio, and we finished off the rest of the tracks with him, and I mixed with John. And it got mastered in Portland at a studio that I like in Portland, Oregon. And so the album is sitting finished right now and mastered. And we're just talking to some distribution partners now to get it out there, which would be really cool. If not, if I can't get a deal that I'm happy with, because a lot of the record industry, now that it, as you know, fallen apart, there's not as much demand for physical product.
Mm-hmm.
So the record label these days, the remaining few majors that are out there, often want to do what is called a 360 deal, which I'm sure you're familiar
mm-hmm.
with what that is.
Yeah, to my listeners, that basically just encompasses all streams for revenue for an artist, from live to albums to so on and so forth. Go ahead.
So I'm not willing to do that kind of a deal. So I've been out just actively looking for a distribution deal that doesn't take my live and my merchandising and my publishing. And, I'm looking to do more of a 50-50 type of deal where it's just physical products and downloads. And if that, you know what, I'm going to give it a couple months here and see what happens. And if it doesn't appear as though any of those kind of deals are out there, then you can count on this album coming out probably before the end of the new year, before 2015 is finished, on Big Sister Records, which will be my independent imprint, and it'll be available, you know, in all social media areas as well. So, yeah.
I've got to ask you to tell a few road stories I'm curious about. One involves a medieval battle with fire extinguishers and dinner trays, and the other involves a man wheeling a chicken on stage in a dress. The floor is yours.
You have done some bizarre research, my friend.
I'm a strange, strange man.
Yeah, we got it. I'm trying to even remember which hotel. It was somewhere in Europe, I think. But yeah, we got completely out of hand one night, which we didn't get out of hand that often, but it was one of those sort of nights that went sideways, and a club owner there had stayed open after hours just for us and plied us with all kinds of fabulous appetizers and alcohol, and it turned into an epic battle in the hallway of a hotel with the lids for room service trays and the fire extinguisher. That's all I'll say, but we managed to get ourselves evicted by the following morning. So it was pretty interesting. I think in the end I ended up hiding behind my door because I was losing. But yeah, one of those crazy things. And then, yes, one of the things that's pretty common on tour is when you're on tour with another band, you know, for a several week run or something like that, you become pretty chummy and good friends. And it's sort of a tradition, it used to be anyway, that on the last night of the tour, you had to prank the other band while they were on stage. You know, some crazy thing. One night I came in in Europe. Now, this is a different story. We had played with a British band named Monroe, and we came in, and our road crew had set up the lighting trusses and everything to look like they'd almost fallen down. It was the most bizarre lighting setup I had that night. So that was one. But another one was we were on tour with Kim Mitchell years ago. And it was the last night of the tour, and I was singing away, and Paul DeLong, their drummer at the time, walked out on stage in high heels, a dress, a roasted chicken on a roller skate, and a pair of underwear on his head. And I think they were mine, and I still don't know how he got them. It was a sight to behold, but yeah. Anyway, needless to say, I forgot a few lines. But yeah, those were great times. Those were fabulous, fun times, I have to say.
Sounds like... Well, not to go from fun times to bad times, but you worked with legendary producer Bob Ezrin on Call of the Wild, and I read that this was not exactly a great experience for you, and that he actually locked the band out of the studio at one point. What the fuck was going on there?
Well, I have to preface this by saying, you know, it was a long time ago. It was sort of in the cocaine-fueled 80s.
Cocaine is a hell of a drug.
A lot of crazy stuff was going on. I have a tremendous respect for Bob Ezrin. I just think, I mean, obviously, he's a production god, this guy. You know, he knows talent and stuff when he sees it. But, he flew up his buddy Dick Wagner from, I think, L.A. at the time. And those two had a long history together, and they got cohorting in the studio, and they got some ideas about these tracks, and I'm sure it all sounded really great at the time. But yeah, at one point, Albania and I, my co-writer, were locked out of the studio for multiple hours at a time, and when they came out, they're like, okay, it sounds great. It was the beginning of barely holding on, actually, I think. We're like, okay, this is perfect. Come on in. We got it. And it was, seriously, the vocals and click track. And we're like, really? This is what took you 7 hours? So it was one of those crazy things. But yeah, back in the good old days, it was a really different production experience for me. So I wasn't, and I was young, so I was not that thrilled. But you know what? That was one of my biggest selling albums in Europe. The Europeans loved it. So Bob did something right. So.
Well, I mean, certainly, you know, I wasn't bringing it up to try to slander the guy or anything. I mean, he's produced and engineered some of, you know, my favorite albums, and especially like his work with Kiss and Alice Cooper. I realize his name's on the record, but I mean, it's your fucking record. Like, locking you out of the studio for your own record, that's fucked up to me.
Yeah, but you know what? He was like again, a production god, and I was just like this little kid making my third record. I think I was 22
right.
at the time, you know? So... Yeah. So I didn't feel like I had a lot of weight to pull around at that time.
Fair enough. Now, you released Body Rock in 89, which became your most successful album. And after 14 months of touring, you had a platinum album, which is certainly an incredible accomplishment. But it came with a huge price, including a failed marriage and burnout. I was hoping that you could talk about the struggle of trying to balance a relationship and the life of a touring musician, and if, in hindsight, the sacrifices were worth it.
That's a really loaded question.
Well, and I mean that with all due respect to your ex-husband and everything as well.
Yeah, it is definitely hard. I think it's even harder for a woman because, you know, if you marry somebody, I mean, at that time I had no children, but if you marry someone and there's, any remote, if you are the artist and the star and if there's any remote expectation you actually are going to actually take on wear the role of wife hat, you're probably going to be disappointed because, you know, at that stage in my life, when you have an album that takes off like that, it's sort of like a steam engine that you can't put the brakes onto. And so it's this thing that, you know, you have to go with it and you have to monetize it while you can. You have to tour when you can. You have to do your promotion. You have to seize the moment. So, you know, it's a different situation when you are, say, an artist like U2, or you get to that level reasonably quickly in your career where you can afford to be carting your entire family around on a tour bus because you have the luxury of those kind of finances. Mm-hmm. I wasn't in that position. Body Rock was my fifth album, but it was the first album that really took off in a big way for me. And so we were still in a building stage. So in hindsight, what do I have to say about that? I have to say that, with all due respect to my ex, it probably wouldn't have worked out anyway.
Right.
Regardless of the touring, I don't know that we were the most well-matched people. But balancing art, especially music, and a family life, it's definitely a challenge. And, you know, there's a reason why people like Kate Bush and Chrissy Hynde and myself took, like, I think Kate Bush took more than a decade. I took a decade off of recording. I mean, in the last decade, I've managed to put out a few releases that didn't require any intensified studio time and do, you know, a handful of shows here and there. But in terms of launching something and being committed to touring it, that's a whole other story. And even with this new album, I'm committed to working it, but I'm not committed to going out and doing, you know, 6 months of little club dates all across Canada. That's something that's just not realistic for my life. So the way I approach it now is to go out and do pockets of dates, like what I'm doing with coming to Kingston, Oshawa, and Hamilton. And, you know, I was offered an Ottawa and a Toronto play, but I think, like I told the agent, I don't want to do it all at once, like Ottawa, Toronto, and London, that I'd rather come back and do another pocket. So, yeah, so I'm coming in and doing like 2-3 shows at a time and approaching it more that way where you do targeted markets.
Yeah, no, that absolutely makes sense to me, yeah.
You know, and I had a conversation a few years back. I worked with Hart on a show, and Nancy Wilson and I had this whole conversation about how do you make it work when you have a family? And her, we call it the weekend warrior. That we go out and we do weekend shows, and we continue to do what we do. We just do it in a different way.
Part talk show, part rock show. You are listening to The Casey Ferguson Show. That was the second part of my conversation with Juno Award winner Lee Aaron. I will have the third and final part of my conversation with Lee Aaron on a future episode of The Casey Ferguson Show. I play it for you now, but there's a lot to get to on this episode, so unfortunately, you're going to have to wait.
Now we play the waiting game. Oh, the waiting game sucks. Let's play Hungry Hungry Hippos.
I am pleased to report that Lee signed a distribution deal and we can expect her new album in the first quarter of 2016. For updates, check out LeeAaron.com.